From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In a letter to lawmakers today, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff described the impeachment hearings that will begin tomorrow as a solemn undertaking and said everyone, including President Trump, would be treated fairly. This week marks the first public hearings on impeachment since President Bill Clinton was impeached in 1998.
William Jefferson Clinton is not a king. He is our president. You have the power and the duty to remove him for office for high crimes and misdemeanors.
Some Americans also remember the Senate hearings into President Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal back in 1973.
The questions that have been raised in the wake of the June 17 break-in strike at the very undergirding of our democracy. If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States.
Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, as you hear those two clips from years ago, what is your feeling about the importance of what is happening this week?
Well, these are the moments when Congress tries to lay out its case, either through witnesses or through the speeches of members themselves. And these are really, really relevant to public opinion and related to that to the opinion of members of the Senate as to was this a corruption of power or not.
What is the first thing you're going to be watching for tomorrow?
What the witnesses say. I think ultimately that's going to be the most important, the weight of the testimony. Do they have enough to draw a big picture for the public about how the president conducted foreign policy in bad ways? And then the second thing is how the parties try to handle this. Republicans will smear, they'll distract, they're going to try to do everything possible so you're not focused on the witnesses. And the question is, can Democrats figure out a way to handle that?
And do you think that lawmakers in both parties are keeping an open mind as they head into this week?
I'm not persuaded by that. I do think there's an imbalance between the parties. The Democrats were very slow to reach this point. So they did, as a party, let the facts drive them to this moment, which many people, including Speaker Pelosi, didn't want to be in. But so far, at least, the Republicans on the committees have not really had an open mind. And so that's part of what we're watching. Is there any fact, is there any development, smoking gun testimony that can shake that partisan status quo?
When you listen back to that tape that we just played from the impeachment of President Clinton and the hearings that were going on into President Nixon, what are the parallels between what we're seeing now and what we saw then?
Well, both ultimately were questions about the abuse of presidential power. That's the big picture here. While we're focusing on the story of Ukraine, that's what Congress was looking in 1973 and then 74, and that's what they saw. And similar, that's what Republicans, the case they wanted to make back in 1998. I think the 73-74 moment is more instructive in many ways because ultimately Congress was able to paint a very big picture of systematic abuse of power by the president and put together different moments, different people that all supported this. And so that's what the current House needs to aspire to if they're going to make the case.
Well, and back then, of course, they didn't get very far, did they? Because President Nixon resigned from office.
Sure. He resigned and the House as a whole didn't have to make a decision. And so we don't actually know how that would have looked or what would have happened in the Senate, although most people suspect President Nixon would have been removed from office. It was also watched in a very different medium. It was three networks. There wasn't really partisan news at the time. And so we had a public commons where people watched this unfold. Today, we have a fragmented commons and a very partisan commons. And so that will affect the politics of the hearings themselves.
How so? I mean, and I'm thinking also of social media, which is going to be live tweeting and live commenting on everything that's going on in the next couple of days.
Well, no one's going to collectively see the same thing. They're going to see bits and pieces of these hearings. I suspect that's what a lot of people, how they will experience it. And B, they will watch these, but then it will be followed up by very partisan commentary that will say, look at this, but this is what it all meant. And so it's much harder for the House of Representatives to sustain a national conversation and to, quote unquote, educate the public when people will literally see different facts before them.
And we've heard reporting that the Democrats would like to get the biggest newsy moments out of the hearings right at the beginning in that first 45 minutes tomorrow. Do you think that we're going to hear anything in these public hearings that might actually shift public opinion one way or the other?
We could. I mean, look at what has happened since the whistleblower revealed what went on and everyone else came out in the private hearings to support that. It has shifted public opinion. It's lent more support to the idea of impeachment and even to removal. Nationally, the president is not in good standing right now, even though he's doing well with Republicans. So I think what we've learned from Ukraine is evidence that the facts can still matter. They have to be dramatic. They have to be clear. But there is a possibility.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And again, many NPR stations will be carrying those hearings live tomorrow. Julian, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And now to an update on former President Jimmy Carter, who is recovering from brain surgery at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. Carter underwent surgery to relieve pressure on his brain that was caused by bleeding after a couple of recent falls. He is the oldest living president in U.S. history at 95 years old, which brings to question the delicate act of performing surgery on older adults. To talk more about this, we have with us Dr. Robert Solomon, chairman of Columbia's Department of Neurosurgery. Dr. Solomon, welcome.
Hi.
So, doctor, you specialize in the surgical treatment of cerebral vascular disease, which is caused by damage to the brain from an interruption of its blood supply. How invasive is brain surgery, with the understanding that there are lots of different types of cerebral vascular disease?
Well, the type of brain surgery required for Mr. Carter has nothing to do with interruption of blood flow to the brain, as best I can tell. It has to do with bleeding on the surface of the brain. So that is not a very invasive procedure to drain a blood clot off of the surface of the brain as compared to any other type of direct surgery on the blood vessels of the brain. So I don't think that he had an occlusion of any blood vessel of the brain or something like that.
In Mr. Carter's case, he went into surgery to relieve pressure on his brain that was caused by bleeding. He's since come out of that surgery. But we've been thinking a lot about his age. I think it was the first thing that came to question for us. How do doctors decide if a patient is too old for surgery?
Well, I think I don't really know the details of Mr. Carter's case, but from what I gather, he has a subdural hematoma, which is a blood clot that's putting pressure on the brain, but not really inside the brain. And so that resides right on the surface, and through a very tiny opening in the skull called a burr hole, that blood can usually be drained out without major trauma and usually under local anesthesia. So somebody even in their 90s could withstand that type of surgery, which is really very minimally invasive.
And you said that right there, even someone in their 90s. Overall, what are some of the risks of operating on older patients?
Well, if they require general anesthesia, then that obviously greatly complicates the risk, because anybody in their 90s undergoing general anesthesia has very significant risks of having cardiopulmonary complications just from the anesthesia. If the operation can be done under local, which means just injection of numbing agents into the scalp and not really completely anesthetizing the patient, then it's much safer in terms of any type of systemic complications or cardiopulmonary problems.
As I mentioned, Carter is out of surgery, and it's being reported that it was without complications. But I think about some of my loved ones who are of that age and the recovery time that it takes for them, even for minor things that they're going in to see the doctor for. How much time would you expect recovery to take for something like this?
Well, It's highly variable. And again, in people of this age, the problem has to do with the atrophy of the brain. The brain is usually shrunken in comparison to the size of the skull, so that even though you drain out the fluid that's putting pressure on the brain doesn't instantly respond and expand back up to fill the space that was filled by the blood clot. That can greatly delay the recovery period and may produce secondary complications if there's a virtual space now inside the skull. Blood and fluid can accumulate again in that space. So this is a big complicating factor for somebody in their 90s undergoing this type of drainage procedure.
Well, we wish the best to Mr. Carter as he is now out of surgery. We're told without complications and resting. Dr. Robert Solomon is the chairman of Columbia's Department of Neurosurgery. Dr. Solomon, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Here and Now.
I just broke up with my girlfriend because I lied to impress her. Have you guys ever done this? And then it always comes back at you. Geez, when that space shuttle landed and I wasn't on it, I couldn't.
Some comedy from the late Gary Shandling, who died in 2016 at age 66 from pulmonary thrombosis. Shandling was not only a groundbreaking comic, he was a mentor to others, including writer-director Judd Apatow. Apatow has a new book of Shandling's journals and jokes out this week. It's called It's Gary Shandling's Book, and he joins us now. Judd Apatow, welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, and when did you first meet Gary Shandling?
I met Gary when I was 15 or 16 years old. In high school, I desperately wanted to talk to comics, so I started a radio show for my high school radio station, and I would trick comedians into talking to me by pretending it wasn't a high school radio station. And I interviewed Gary over the phone. It was a few weeks after he had hosted The Tonight Show for the first time, which is a big deal for a young comedian. And I had this great chat with him. He was hilarious. And then I met him many years later, 5 or 6 years later, and I got hired to write jokes for him for the Grammy Awards. And that's, you know, when our friendship began.
Well, and the friendship really developed because you talk in your introduction about after he died, you went over, went through his house, found boxes of photos and his journals, which make up this book.
Yeah, after he died, you know, someone had to go through everything. And I think because I loved Gary so much, and also I'm a hoarder, and the idea of all of his stuff just disappearing was not something that I could handle.
Well, one of the amazing things is that the journal entries go back to when he was a kid. He was writing down his thoughts about his life and jokes.
Yes, there's stuff in this book which is, you know, a combination of, you know, like a scrapbook and an oral history of Gary. But yeah, we did find jokes that he wrote when he was in college, and you know, we trace his history, you know, right to his earliest days. Living in Arizona, he had a brother who had cystic fibrosis, and the family moved to Arizona for him. And then his brother died when Gary was 10 and his brother was 13. And that really seemed to be, you know, a defining moment in Gary's development. The family dealt with it in a way that was not unique to the time. You know, they dealt with it by not talking about it. And I think that that really wounded Gary, and it didn't allow him to grieve in a normal, healthy way. And as a result, that loss, you know, stayed with him, you know, for his entire life.
Well, and when he first started doing stand-up comedy, and this is his first ever Comedy Store set. You have a joke that he told. He said, "You don't know what it was like being an unwanted child. My mother had tried to talk her doctor into performing an abortion, but he said he wouldn't do it because it was illegal to perform an abortion once the child had reached the age of 15. But did he have a difficult relationship with his mother?
I think that he did. You know, his mom, you know, was a real character. And when his brother died, it felt like his mom had a really hard time with it and then focused all of her energy on Gary. And I think that engulfment was more than he could handle. He had a lot of jokes about it. He won an award once and he gave it to his mom afterwards. And she said to him, "But you didn't thank me on TV." And he's like, "But mom, I'm giving you the award now. I'm here with you now. Would it be better if I did it on TV?" And she said, "Yes." Gary had a joke where he said, "My mom wants me to have kids, just not with other people."
You know, you talk about this in this book, and he talks about it as well, that a big part of his humor was opening up, being honest with the audience, and being very personal.
Yes, I think that at some point he realized that the journey in his creativity was to just go deep into himself and share his life and his feelings and his story with other people. That made his stand-up kind of deeper and richer. He had a great joke where he said, "My friends tell me I have an intimacy problem, but they don't really know me." And so if you look at the body of his work, his stand-up became more personal, and then his television work became more personal. It's Gary Shandling Show, you know, was a very funny, imaginative show where he talked to the camera and revealed the studio audience. And then with the Larry Sanders Show, it was a little more of an exploration of both the inside of a talk show, but it was more about show business and ego, and it almost felt like Gary wanted to explore a side of himself that he didn't like. He didn't like that he wanted to be a star. He didn't like that he wanted all the attention. So he created this character which was even worse than he was, and he made fun of it. It's almost like he was mocking the part of himself that he wanted to get rid of.
Well, and I have to say, as somebody who is 37 now, the Larry Sanders Show is where I first discovered Gary Shandling, and I want to play a clip of it. He played a talk show host named Larry Sanders. A lot of famous people appeared as guests on his show, including Sharon Stone. Here's a clip with the two of them.
"Oh, I feel so uncomfortable when I do these shows."
"Really? Well, so do I."
"You do?
Yeah.
You're so good at it."
"No, trust me, I hate myself." "So what does someone like you do now?"
"Tonight?"
"Yeah."
"I'm having dinner with Oliver Stone."
"Wow, that's just what I imagined someone like you doing, having dinner with Oliver Stone. He's
Larry,
such an interesting
Larry,
guy."
"Larry, what are you doing here during the show? Is there a problem or something?"
"There's no problem. I'm walking Miss Stone out. Common courtesy."
"Oh, right. Right. Good. There's a lot of gang activity in this part of the hallway."
So is there something – because he did, as you said, he hosted the Tonight Show, the real-life Tonight Show, to fill in for Johnny Carson. Was there something that he thought he was able to do with Larry Sanders' show that he wasn't able to do in real life or that he wanted to do?
I think one of the inspirations for the Larry Sanders Show was that Gary was at the Tonight Show filling in as a guest host, and he sees Little Richard in the hallway, and he's very upset about something and having a problem, and he's watching the producer, Peter LaSalle, talk Little Richard down from some problem or complaint, and that he just found that side of it so funny, that what was more interesting was the stuff happening behind the scenes. And that's what fascinated Gary. You know, he always said that the show was about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way. And I think that was his philosophy for all of his creativity, that it's all about what are the obstacles to love.
I want to listen to a clip of The Tonight Show in part just because I love listening to Gary Shandling tell some jokes. But this is when he was a guest on The Tonight Show in March of 1981 talking about his dog.
"Irish setters are too hyper and inbred, like my cousin Stuart. And what happens when it thunders, she digs up the carpet to get underneath the carpet to get away from the thunder. And the vet gave me these animal tranquilizers to give her. You know, they're doggy downers or something. I don't know what they are, but they tasted real minty and they were hard to swallow."
So Judd Apatow One of the things I thought was so interesting about his experience with The Tonight Show is you see the notes in this book that he wrote about it, and it seemed like he had to remind himself how great it was that he got to host The Tonight Show and that actually he was a success in this world, even if he clearly was still very self-critical.
I mean, he really prepared to do this kind of work psychologically. I feel like Gary was ahead of the curve with a lot of what people talk about now in terms of manifesting your dreams, visualizing what you will do in advance, the way athletes do. He knew from early on that he wanted to host The Tonight Show, and he was aware that he had to be really funny with Johnny in order to succeed on that show. And a lot of his preparation was mentally preparing to be loose and funny in the moment. So it wasn't just memorizing his jokes. He had to be in a mental space to be quick and sharp and think of something in that moment. And that, I think, connected to all of his Buddhist ideas about presence and trusting that if you're confident, the great joke will come in the moment.
Tell me about the Buddhism part of Gary Shandling.
I don't know if Gary considered himself a Buddhist, but when you go through his journals, you know, he's writing these reminders to himself, and it's like classic Buddhist ideas about, you know, letting go, no mind. And, you know, he'd say the ego desires, desire breeds suffering. And, you know, these are classic Buddhist ideas, but they were very important to Gary because he was struggling to figure out a way to be creative and not be an egomaniac and not be obsessed with how people were reacting to him and trying to be successful. So it's interesting because he was this neurotic man who loved talking about the obsession with success. But at the same time, he was constantly saying to himself, none of this matters.
Why do you think he kept all these notes over the years?
I think that as a thoughtful, spiritual person and also a single man through much of his life, he developed, you know, a higher voice that talked him off the ledge. So most of his journals are not complaining journals. They're reminders to himself about how he wants to behave. It's almost like he's created this adult voice who's talking to him and just, you know, saying, calm down. It's okay. You know, only love, you know, just let go.
Well, I laughed, I cried reading this book. It is fantastic, especially for people who have an appreciation already, at least somewhat, of Gary Shandling. Judd Apatow, editor of It's Gary Shandling's Book, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There are currently 17 Democrats running to be president of the United States, and perhaps there will soon be 19. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is considering entering the race just days after New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg filed to run in Alabama. And by the way, he just filed in Arkansas as well. The deadline to file in New Hampshire is Friday, and the Iowa caucuses are less than 3 months away. So let's bring in NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
So Deval Patrick, one of the most high-profile African-American leaders in the Democratic Party, what would his entry into the race mean?
It would, first of all, be incredibly late. Deval Patrick is one of several Democrats who this time a year ago we were looking at as people who were considering getting into the race. Elizabeth Warren got in December of 2018. A lot of other candidates followed. Patrick is talking about hopping into the race literally days, as you mentioned, before the filing deadline in New Hampshire. It would be a last-minute bid without all of the organizational groundwork, staffing, and fundraising that you have seen all these other candidates do for almost a year now. That being said, people like Patrick, people like Michael Bloomberg, and importantly, a lot of establishment Democratic leaders and the donor class are looking at this field and saying nobody has really left their mark, and the candidates who are doing well, we're worried, might be a tough sell to voters next fall.
But wouldn't a Patrick or a Bloomberg take votes away from somebody like Joe Biden?
Probably. Yeah. When Bloomberg made this announcement, I talked to former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, who's worked with Mike Bloomberg a lot, really likes him, but also has endorsed Joe Biden. And he said that was his specific worry I think a reason a Patrick and a Bloomberg are looking in to get into this race is they feel like Joe Biden has not done a great job. He has remained steadily on top of the polls, but his fundraising numbers have been far below the other Democratic candidates in the race. And even though Joe Biden continues to do well in head-to-head polls against Donald Trump, there's a lot of concern from Democrats that those numbers might erode over the course of a long campaign.
Scott, these candidates who are thinking about getting in now are also talking a lot about kind of skipping the early states or not spending as much attention on them. You've spent a lot of time in those early states. Could you get to the nomination without really caring that much about Iowa or New Hampshire?
You could. You have to go back a very long way for a strategy where that worked, almost to the time before this modern era of primaries and caucuses being at the center of the nomination process and not just something that you duck into before it's settled at the convention. You know, Mike Bloomberg has talked about waiting until mid-March to hop into the race, or early March, with the big Super Tuesday states, California, Texas, and a ton of other states that vote on March 3rd. That's almost a bet that this will go to a convention where this would be settled by delegates on the floor of the convention, which, again, is not something that's happened since the 1970s or 60s.
And as we keep hearing in the reporting about this, it sounds like the polls show that Democrats, at least voters, seem to be happy with the field right now.
Yeah, and that's an important point. That's something that our colleague Domenico Montanaro points out every single time he's asked about this. Overwhelmingly, polls by NPR and other organizations show that voters are happy. And most importantly, I think you have seen so many signs of just high enthusiasm from Democratic voters, from organizers, from the people who are out doing the canvassing, doing the door knocking, doing the donating to campaigns online already. Democrats are really energized by this race in a way that they frankly were not in 2016. I think there's just mostly a lot of concerns at higher levels about the type of candidates at the top of the field.
Said NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Winter weather has arrived early, and I mean early. We are more than a month away from the beginning of winter, but it has arrived across much of the U.S., and cities from the southern plains to the Mississippi Valley to the Great Lakes could set records today and tomorrow for cold temperatures. Some areas also getting snow. The conditions are dealing another blow to farmers who have been rushing to harvest crops after a challenging year of extreme conditions. Joining us now is Teresa Sisson, crop specialist with the Michigan Farm Bureau. She's in East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
And tell us what it's like there right now. How cold is it, and is there snow on the ground?
There is a lot of snow on the ground. It's about 15 degrees out right now. We got, I believe, around 5 inches of snow or so yesterday. There's a few flurries, but the sun was actually shining today, so it looks really pretty out if you don't mind the cold.
And what are your concerns when it comes to the crops and farmers there?
So one of the big concerns is the fact that we're very behind in harvest. We got a really late start this spring because it rained so much this spring. It was too wet and too cold, really, to get out into the fields. So we're really behind when it comes to harvest. And all this snow and the cold weather makes harvest just that much more challenging for these farmers.
And how unusual is it to have it at this time of the year?
It's normal for us to get some flurries or things, but typically not as much snow as what we got. And it's pretty rare for it to be this cold in the middle of November.
And scientists saying it's another example of how climate change will continue to impact agriculture, not just in Michigan, but in other parts of the country as well. You help out on your family's farm on nights and weekends about 30 miles north of Lansing. What's it been like for you this harvest season?
It's been tough. It's been a really long harvest. We probably won't see a whole lot of soybeans harvested until the snow goes away, because when you're harvesting soybeans, you basically have to run your combine head almost on the ground in order to cut that plant off and get all the soybeans in. And you don't want to bring in all the snow that's out there, because it will actually cause the inside of the combine to freeze up. So we probably won't see any soybeans harvested till that snow's gone. It's been a real challenge this year.
And what would you say the morale is like for farmers right now? There was a story over the weekend about a farmer who had committed suicide because things were so bad this year.
I think it's all over the board. There's obviously, farmers are the eternal optimist. Otherwise, it'd be pretty tough to be a farmer every year. So there's those that are still pretty positive. They're pretty upbeat. And then there's those that it's really taken a toll on them.
The issue you're dealing with right now is the cold weather. And as you say, a late start to the season because of flooding. What about the other stress that farmers are dealing with this year, which is The tariffs and the trade war with China. China's the biggest buyer of many U.S. crops, including soybeans. How is that impacting you at this point?
So it's impacted prices a lot just because so many of our crops and products are exported. We're seeing some positive news with positive developments with trade in Japan, potentially with trade, you know, with China of hopefully having some agreement. So that's helping. Really this year, though, the biggest challenge, I think probably one of the bigger things the farmers were just focused on was how do I get my crops in the ground in the spring and now how do I get them out?
Do you think that those of us around the rest of the country are going to feel later what you're feeling right now with this early cold weather?
I think what farmers have went through this year could definitely impact the general public later on. I think the first group it will hit will be those local, small rural communities, because when farmers have that extra disposable income, they spend it locally. They, you know, buy new vehicles, or they get new equipment, or they go to the local diner, they donate to, you know, local fundraisers. So they won't have the income to be able to do some of those things. So those will be the first ones to feel it. And depending on how this harvest goes, we may see some price increases at the grocery store. Really, the farmers receive a very small percentage of what you actually pay for food at the grocery store. So what they're going through has a small impact on that. But depending on how this harvest turns out across the country, we may see some increases there.
That is Teresa Sissung, who's a crop specialist with the Michigan Farm Bureau, joining us today from East Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now to coastal cities and efforts to protect them from sea level rise and flooding. Last year, the Army Corps of Engineers received $17.4 billion from Congress to study ways to reduce risks to these communities. In September, the Corps offered some potential solutions for one of the places where the stakes are very high, Miami-Dade County in Florida. But as Jenny Stiletovich of WLRN reports, some homeowners and activists worry about equity and whether million-dollar properties will receive the lion's share of the protection.
That's 14-month-old Charlie Cheek. Just before he was born, his parents bought their first house in a neighborhood off Miami's Biscayne Boulevard.
We moved here because it was a great community. There's an elementary school that we like. And we found a house with a great backyard and big avocado trees that we were excited about.
It wasn't just the avocado trees, the school, and neighbors that drew Jennifer Cheek here. It was also reasonable flood insurance and freedom from the stress of living in a flood-prone neighborhood like the one she and her husband left in Miami Beach.
Obviously, being in Miami, everywhere is a little bit prone, but we did spend some time looking at the maps and talking with neighbors and real estate agents and everyone we could to make sure we found somewhere that at least didn't have a history of flooding.
So Cheek wasn't that surprised when she went to a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer meeting recently. It was an early look at a flood control plan around Biscayne Bay.
You have some problems that are just epic in scale and that are not duplicated. Well, they're duplicated in very few places.
Joe Vitri is in charge of coming up with fixes for flooding along the entire Atlantic coast. And Jennifer Cheek was paying close attention.
I said, that's my neighborhood, you know, and pointed to the map where the flood wall was proposed.
What she wasn't prepared to see was where the Corps was considering installing a massive flood wall, about two blocks from her house.
And when I asked if they knew specifically how much space would be required to buy out on either side of the wall, she said that was wouldn't be known until the study was complete.
In addition to flood walls, the Corps is considering flood gates across three rivers that dump into Biscayne Bay, and they're looking at elevating some properties. They may also recommend natural barriers, since mangroves and wetlands can buffer waves and soak up floodwater. But the plan to buy out property owners may be drawing the most attention, especially from social justice advocates.
Our concern is that communities that are vulnerable and that don't have high-income real estate properties are going to be left behind.
Natalie Barefoot is director of the Environmental Justice Clinic at the University of Miami's Law School. If a flood wall costs, say, $10 million to protect a neighborhood filled with million-dollar houses, that will probably be seen as a tax base worth protecting. But in poorer neighborhoods, value may not always be counted in dollars. Maybe it's the time it takes to get to work, being close to family, or staying at the same school. Maybe it's just having lived a lifetime in the same house.
By choosing an area We are infusing wealth into that area, and we are not infusing it into other areas.
To identify areas with chronic problems, the Corps looked at past flood damage, says Susan Connor. She's managing the study for the Army Corps of Engineers and says they're considering a mix of fixes.
It's a difficult topic, but it's something to consider on those properties where nothing else might be able to solve the issue.
Connor says the fixes that will ultimately be recommended depend on which properties the Army Corps finds worth protecting. Environmentalists say the Corps also needs to take a harder look at saving what's left of the state's own best defenses, mangroves, seagrass beds, dunes, and reefs. Rachel Silverstein is a marine biologist and executive director of Miami Waterkeeper. She worries the Corps' environmental track record in the state, from port expansions to draining the Everglades, does not bode well for those natural barriers.
They can thrive here if they're just given the space to do that. They can really act like sponges and living storm breaks.
Some of those natural barriers are being woven into local plans. If local officials don't like the Corps' final plan, they say they can come up with their own design, but that could mean losing federal funding. Homeowner Jennifer Cheek says she'd be willing to make the sacrifice and sell to make way for a flood wall. But what she won't settle for is a plan that ignores the things that are harder to quantify, parks and riverwalks, or mangroves and wetlands that restore some of Florida's lost habitat.
I would be pretty furious if that's why they were asking us to leave, to uproot everything, because this was the cheapest and easiest stopgap measure at the moment.
The Army Corps is continuing to seek public input. They hope to have a final plan signed by the Chief of Engineers in 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Stiletovich.
President Trump tweeted today that many DACA recipients were, quote, far from angels. That's the same day that the Supreme Court is hearing arguments about his administration's decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. A lot of people are paying close attention to today's arguments. Graysa Martinez is one of them. She's with the immigrant youth organization United We Dream, and she's also a DACA recipient. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, as I mentioned, you're a leader within United We Dream. Just a few days ago, your organization organized a nationwide protest to raise awareness around DACA. But we'd love to know a little bit more about you. When did you first come to this country with your family?
You know, I came to the U.S. when I was 7 years old with my mom and my dad and my youngest sister. I remember crossing the Rio Grande waters in Texas and finally landing in Dallas, Texas, which is where I call home.
Did you always know about your immigration status?
My parents were very honest with me about my immigration status. I remember being 6 years old and really feeling in my bones what it meant to have to hide a little bit or ask the question in the back of your mind, like, will this be the day that they find out I don't have papers? But it was also a part of me which says that, like, you have to find people that you trust and ask for help. And I think that I was really lucky to have educators that really reached out and saw something in me that allowed me to be able to blossom.
Yeah. Those educators, were they the ones that told you about DACA or had your parents told you?
I was actually part of the campaign to win DACA after the loss of the DREAM Act in 2010. And so I remember being part of the group that sort of imagined this idea of demanding protection from the administration and in my mind thinking, oh, man, how are we going to make that happen? We demonstrated. We came to Washington, D.C. We spoke to the White House. And, you know, in a matter of 2 years, we were able to deliver the victory of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
And that was in 2012. And then 2017 comes along and the Trump administration decides to end DACA. And during that time, we heard so many stories from Dreamers who are really pleading for their humanity. What have the last few years been like for you since Trump's decision?
One thing that I always want to remind myself of is that Donald Trump a promise that he would end the DACA program on day one of his administration. And so the fact that we've been able to fight back, to have courageous lawyering help put injunctions into the DACA program in the last 3 years has been really monumentous for our movement. And so there's a lot of victory and joy in being able to have extended protections for people like myself. But it also means that this, you know, it's important to put this into context. This is one part of a larger fight for us. It's about 11 million undocumented people.
We focus a lot on the Dreamers who are or were in school. Many of them are really exceptional Ivy League graduates, executives in Fortune 500 companies. But the benefit of DACA is really much broader than this. I spoke to a DACA recipient from Harvard who was very pointed in letting me know that he's thinking about his cousins who may not get to the levels that he's gotten to, but are still profoundly impacted. Can you talk about that impact for a moment?
When I think about the impact of DACA, I think about people like my mom who, you know, everybody knows how hard it is to take 3 buses just to get to work really early in the morning. And when I got DACA, we were able to go and get a car and she helped me choose it. And that trek to work became a lot simpler. It allowed me to help her in the last days of her life be able to have the access to medicine and information and doctors that were trying to help her survive her non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's actually about DACA is a symbol that immigrants and our communities are here to stay, and we're going to here to fight to make sure that our dignity is recognized.
The president has the legal authority to end DACA, but what the Supreme Court is actually looking at in these 3 cases is whether the administration has legitimate justification for ending the program. You'll actually be at the hearings listening, but if you could speak, what would you say to the justices?
The Supreme Court has heard cases about the humanity of women in this country, of Black people in this country, of LGBTQ people, and those have marked our history. And so is this case, one of those opportunities to mark our history into a new direction. But no matter what their decision is next year, immigrant young people of United We Dream, undocumented people all across the country, we're ready to fight.
And what does that fighting look like? What's next for your activism?
We are organizing in our communities. We just had a mass walkout of high school students all across the country. I think what you'll see is this moment be a catalyst for young people across the country that are inspired by the Sunrise Movement, by the Movement for Black Lives, young immigrants really demanding dignity for themselves and doing so in a joyful rebellion.
That's Graysa Martinez, DACA recipient and the Deputy Executive Director of United We Dream. Graysa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.